All right, week two of our Skeptics Forum series. I know last week was like a dump truck of information, but hey, you all came back. So you're gluttons for punishment. You're here for more. So week two, so I'm not going to recap everything that we talked about last week. If you're wondering, on our website, npmbchurch.com, you can go online and under the sermon page, listen to the sermons, and the life group training videos are under there, and life group study questions are under there. Or if you follow us on Facebook, North Peace MB Church, we post all of our sermons to Facebook and all the videos, and so you can catch up. But basically, we talked about this assumption or this false belief that faith is opposed to reason and science. Now, we don't have time to rehash everything, but basically we had this idea of, you know, faith is over here and faith is for dim-witted, not very smart people, and reason and science is for the intellectual and those who want to use logic and use their brains, and, you know, they clash at each other. And one of the reasons we saw is that our culture is biased towards presenting that view. Someone reminded me after the service that the Governor General of Canada a few months ago in a speech came out, and I'm just paraphrasing her because I don't remember exactly what she said, but essentially she said, we're a science-based culture. Anyone who believes in creation is like, that's been proven wrong, and you can't even come into the conversation anymore. Obviously, evolution and science has proved that all wrong. And she got some flack for it, but the next day Trudeau said, yeah, everything that she says is right. We're a science-based country, and that stuff is just nonsense. So it's a bias that is pushed by our culture to present this idea that, well, faith is over here and reason is over here. And so we saw last week that faith is not opposed to science or reason or logic. And actually the study of science and the use of reason actually points to God, not away from God. So this morning the question we want to ask is there evidence for the existence of God? And really this kind of builds on the premise of last week, because we're using reason and logic and evidence and science, and we believe that that actually points to God. So then the question is, you know, is there actually solid evidence that God actually exists? Now, for some of you, this is a non-issue, especially maybe you've grown up in the church, you became a follower of Jesus really little, and you've just never had that type of doubt in your life. That's some of you. But I know for lots of us, some of you maybe here don't believe in God, and you're here because you're wondering about some of these questions or what do Christians believe. That's awesome that you are here. Some of you, maybe you've had seasons of doubt in God. Like for me, and I shared last week, I grew up as a missionary kid, pastor's kid, became a Christian or surrendered to Jesus when I was like 4 years old. And I can remember maybe like 3 days in my entire life where I questioned the existence of God, where different things happened. And I remember in high school specifically having those moments where you're like, what if this is all a lie? What if some guy named Bob wrote the Bible in his mom's basement and we're all just believing this? And what if it's not actually true? What if God doesn't exist? What if atheism is true? And then I remember it didn't last long because I just kind of got over it, but I had several days of doubt like that where I would go, man, what if God isn't real? And I know a lot of you, when different circumstances come into your life, you question the existence of God. What if none of this is true? What if there actually isn't a God? That's what we want to ask and answer this morning. Is there evidence for the existence of God? Now, what you have to understand right out of the gate is that you cannot prove or disprove God's existence. We saw last week that idea that science has disproved God, you actually can't disprove the existence of God. But on the flip side, neither can we 100% beyond the shadow of a doubt prove that God exists. Ravi Zacharias said this in his book, The End of Reason. God has put enough into this world to make faith in him a most reasonable thing, but he's left enough out to make it impossible to live by sheer reason alone. So what Ravi is saying is, can you be absolutely confident in your belief in God? Yes. Now, can you prove that belief with absolute certainty? And the answer is no, and I actually don't think that you need to. So we actually can't prove or disprove beyond the shadow of a doubt that God exists, but there are clues and markers that point to his existence. Now, it's interesting because evidence that we gather comes from two forms, facts and experience. And so we can study the facts or the evidence, which we're going to do this morning, but we can actually experience the person of God because he's relational. And so we want to take both of those things, facts and evidence, as well as experience and stories to actually form our belief about God. So this morning we want to examine some clues, like I said, that point to God's existence. Alvin Plantinga, great name, is considered to be one of the greatest living philosophers of our day, and he just happens to be a follower of Jesus, but he has said that there are 2 to 3 dozen very good arguments for the existence of God. But it's interesting because he says that there's no proof of God that will convince all rational persons, but there's these dozens of markers or clues or indicators that point to God's existence. And we're not going to look at all of them this morning, like 36 reasons that God exists. We don't have time. But really, when you boil them down, we're going to look at 3 clues for the existence of God. And really, if you boil them down even further, they have to do with anthropology and cosmology. So Immanuel Kant put it this way. He said, "The moral law within and the starry hosts above." So if last week was hard for you to pay attention, hopefully you brought coffee. We're talking cosmology, anthropology, biology, all of these things. And really, they boil down to people and the universe. Two big proofs or evidences for the existence of God is people and the universe. So we want to talk about the bigness of the universe, the smallness of the universe, and morality as 3 markers to point to God's existence. So to begin, we want to talk about this universe that we live in. When you think about our universe, its sheer size should just make your head spin. Our galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, is 100,000 light years across. So massive. Like, we can't even fathom that type of distance. It's 100,000 light years across, and it's actually estimated that there are 100 to 200 billion galaxies that exist. And so think about that. Here we are on our tiny planet, in our tiny solar system, in a tiny galaxy. Now, here's the fascinating part. For years and years and years, up until 90 years ago, every single scientist believed that the universe was eternal, that the universe just always existed. Aristotle taught this idea thousands of years ago, that the universe just always existed. I don't know, some of you will remember this in science class if you watched the documentary by Carl Sagan. Some of you maybe recognize that name, but it was that, like, oh, we're all stardust. And it was this very, like, weird documentary about atheism. But he said the cosmos is all that is or was or ever will be. It's eternal. And every scientist believed that the universe has always existed and it will always exist for eternity. Now, in 1929, so roughly 80, 90 years ago, a man named Edwin Hubble looked through his telescope and he saw that galaxies were actually moving away from each other at a really fast rate. And so what that meant was that space was actually getting bigger, that the galaxies were moving away from each other. And he was a really smart man, and what he did was, by measuring the speed and the distance that this was happening, he figured out that all galaxies and planets and stars and energy and matter had a common point of origin, and he named that the Big Bang. So most of you know, not the TV show, most of you know the actual hypothesis, this Big Bang idea, that because the universe is expanding, let's work backwards, and we've figured out that it had a starting point. So he actually said, no, the universe isn't eternal, it had a starting point. Now, this is where it gets really interesting, because when Hubble first put that hypothesis out, the scientific community hated it. And actually pushed back on it and rejected it because, get this, they said, by and large, it seemed to give in to the Judeo-Christian worldview of a beginning. So wrap your mind around that for a second. Edwin Hubble proposes, hey, the universe isn't eternal. A Big Bang happened and the universe had a starting point. And it wasn't Christians freaking out about the Big Bang. It was actually secular atheistic scientists going, no, 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 that theory sounds way too similar to the Christian worldview. The universe is eternal. We know that. It didn't have a starting point. And Christians, not freaking out about it, they were saying, oh, so you mean that nothing existed and then there was a flash of light and things came into being? Yeah, we already knew that. They said, it took you long enough to catch up. We already knew that. Genesis 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. So no Christian worried about the Big Bang. They said, finally, you guys caught up. For thousands of years, you've been saying the universe always existed, and we've been saying, no, God made it in the beginning. So I find that fascinating that atheistic, secularist scientists did not like this theory of the Big Bang because it was too similar to Genesis 1:1. That's amazing to me. But now, the scientific evidence that is now accepted as fact is that the universe had a beginning. It had a starting point. The universe is not eternal, and the universe is rapidly expanding. And the amazing thing is that they've calculated that the universe does have an end date. It's not going to exist forever. The universe had a starting point. It's expanding outward, and it's going to continue to expand until all of its energy is expelled. And so scientists rejected this idea because it seemed too Christian. But once the evidence was in and they couldn't deny it, they began to hypothesize, okay, well, we can't deny that the universe had a beginning. So now they're going to hypothesize about why this beginning happened so that we can rule out a creator. And we need to come up with really intense theories so that we don't have to say, well, yeah, fine, someone caused the universe to begin. So skeptics proposed the nothing hypothesis. And I know it's early still, so try and stay. This is very deep thinking. So this is the nothing hypothesis. It goes like this. What caused the Big Bang? Nothing. Did it happen? Yes. What caused it? Nothing. That's their theory. It just happened. What caused it to happen? Well, nothing. So I'm not a mathematician. I'm not a scientist. But that is the laziest hypothesis I've ever heard. We know that the universe started. Well, what caused it to start? Nothing. And so you go, come on, guys. We're trying to be reasonable. We want to use logic. And it makes me laugh so hard that so often the finger is pointed at Christians going, man, you guys are so illogical. You're so unreasonable. It's all faith. Okay, well, what caused the Big Bang? Nah, nothing. Well, how did it begin? Well, it just started. And I'm going, really? That's your answer for how everything came into being? But listen, scientifically speaking, the laws of science have confirmed that everything has to have a cause. Something does not come from nothing, and yet this is the very argument that atheists make. Well, we know things can't come from nothing, and we know that the universe had a starting point, but nothing caused it to happen. And we go, you're using your own science to defeat your own argument. So think about it this way. I can remember as a kid, and some of you have memories like this, one night you're in bed and you hear a noise downstairs, a loud crash. So I called my dad, said, Dad, can you go downstairs? I think there's a murderer here. He's going to kill us all. Let's send Dad down and go see what that was. So my dad went downstairs. I'm pretty sure he just stood at the bottom of the stairs because it was the middle of the night. And he came back up and I said, so Dad, what was it? And he said, it was nothing. Go back to bed. That is a lazy parent move. That's a tired parent wanting to go back to bed. It's nothing. Don't worry about it. It was nothing. Like, that's not an answer. We heard a noise. It can't be nothing. Now, it wasn't a murderer or a robber, but maybe a pot fell on the floor or a book fell off the bookshelf, but nothing is not an acceptable answer. And I remember Dad later on would use phrases like, oh, it's just the house settling. I'm like, what does that mean? It's tired, and then it's nighttime, and the house kind of settles down for bed. And so that's why you hear creaks and groans. And me being a stupid kid, I'm like, oh, yeah, totally. Don't worry, the house is settling. It doesn't make any sense. But nothing is not an acceptable answer. Because when you hear, like, even now, when you, like, let's say you're in bed with your spouse and there's a loud crash downstairs and you go check, you wouldn't say, well, even if you do say, well, it was nothing. We all know it's not nothing. Nothing is not an acceptable answer, and yet I find it fascinating that the answer given for why the universe began, what caused it, nothing. Nothing caused it. It just happened. That is a non-answer, and it's lazy. That can't be the answer. So you can begin to see the origin of the universe, how the universe began. It's a problem for someone who has an atheistic worldview. Francis Collins, he was one of the scientists who was involved with mapping out the entire human genome. He said this: we have this very solid conclusion that the universe had an origin. The Big Bang, 15 billion years ago, the universe began with an unimaginably bright flash of energy from an infinitesimally small point. That implies that before that, there was nothing. I can't imagine how nature, in this case the universe, could have created itself. And the very fact that the universe had a beginning implies that someone was able to begin it. And it seems to me that that had to be outside of nature. Now, it's not just the problem of the beginning or the origin of the universe, but it's also the chance of our universe ever coming into existence. So let's assume for a minute, okay? Let's put aside our Christian worldview for a lot of us. Let's just assume that, like atheists propose, there is no outside source causing the universe to happen. Let's assume that creation is not real, there is no creator, like they propose, that the universe just happened, and everything that we see today, where we are in 2018, is all by luck and chance. Let's just assume that. Now, mathematicians have done studies to figure out what is the chance that our universe would ever come into existence and we would ever end up where we are today. What are those odds? And it's fascinating because they've figured out that our chance of this universe coming into existence is one chance. You have one shot in 10 to the power of 138. So that's 10 with 138 zeros behind it. That's the odds. You get one shot in 10 with 138 zeros behind it. Now, we can't even fathom that. So let me give you like a reference point. 10 to the power of 70 is the number of atoms in the universe. Not like dudes named Adam, but like atoms, A-T-O-M, building blocks. The number of atoms in the universe is 10 with 70 zeros behind it. And the chance that our universe would ever come into existence with everything that we need for human life is one chance in 10 with 138 zeros behind it. Massive problem here. And so astrophysicists actually tell us that there were 122 variables that had to all be lined up perfectly in order for the universe to exist. So variables like the constants of physics, the speed of light, the gravitational constants, the strength of the weak and strong nuclear forces, and on and on and on and on and on it goes. 122 constants had to be at work in order for our universe to ever happen. So this is called the fine-tuning argument. So if you can imagine 122 dials, and what scientists have discovered is that all of them had to be dialed in just perfectly in order for our universe to ever happen. And scientists have said that if even one of those 122 constants were off by 1 million millionth, the universe would have never happened. So, and so hear me out. This is not Christians going, what about the fine-tune argument? This is secular scientists going, yeah, the chances are massive that the universe, 122 constants have to be dialed in, and if they're off by a fraction of a degree, the universe would have never happened. Now, the question I have then is, okay, so if there's 122 dials that have to be dialed in, where did those come from? These variables couldn't have happened at the same time as the Big Bang, or they wouldn't work, because they wouldn't be dialed in order for the Big Bang to happen. So these 122 constants had to exist before the universe existed, but how is that possible? So like I said, hear this for sure. This is secular scientists agreeing that the chance of our universe ever happening is so small that it should be categorized as a miracle. Scientists are unanimously saying that it is so small that it exists in the realm of miracle. Richard Dawkins, who is a very famous atheist, he even admits to the fine-tuning principle. He says, yeah, I know, it's 122 constants. They all have to be dialed in. Massively small chance that this would ever happen. Now, skeptics have come up with two arguments against a creator, because they can't deny that there is such fine-tuning in the universe, but they've come up with two arguments against a creator. So Dawkins, Richard Dawkins, actually writes about both of these in his book, The God Delusion. He writes about first these two arguments. First off, he uses what is called the lucky us hypothesis. So it goes like this. Yes, the chances of the universe ever coming into existence are extremely small, but here we are, so lucky us. I'm not making this up. Read The God Delusion. Actually, don't read The God Delusion. But Richard Dawkins, in his book, The God Delusion, he says, yeah, it's so small, but we're here, so it must have happened. Like, this is Dawkins, very smart man, defender of logic and reason, on a crusade against Christianity because he views it as illogical and dumb, and yet his response for how we got here is, well, we're here, so I guess we lucked out. I'm like, come on, man. We want to use our brains, and that is such a lazy excuse. So he says, well, we lucked out. The second answer that he gives is the multiverse theory. He says, well, there might be trillions and trillions of universes, and there might be trillions and trillions of Big Bangs always happening, and so given enough time, one happened where it just kind of happened to work out. Now, the issue with that is there is zero proof that there's trillions and trillions of universes. So again, it's a faith position. And it's fascinating to me that actually I watched a debate between Richard Dawkins and John Lennox. And John Lennox is a Christian mathematician. He's a professor at Oxford. And Dawkins brought up these two ideas. Well, we lucked out, so here we are. And maybe there's an infinite number of universes. And Lennox just kind of laughed and said, man, I can't believe that you devoted so much of your book to those sophomoric, juvenile explanations. He actually said, Dawkins, I expected better from you. And the amazing thing is that Dawkins in that debate said, yeah, I know that neither of those answers is very satisfying, but that's all we've got. That's not me saying that. Dawkins himself, renowned atheist, said, yeah, these answers are not really great, but it's all we've got so far. Those are the two arguments against the creation of the universe, the fine-tuning, that maybe there's just an infinite number of universes. Consider it this way. Alvin Plantinga, we mentioned him already. He uses the example of a poker game. Imagine a man dealt himself. Now, you're Mennonite, so poker is a card game that you play for money. now, imagine a man dealt himself 50 straight royal flushes. Royal flush is the highest hand that you can get in poker. So imagine that. He's sitting with four other friends. Okay, I'll deal. Royal flush. Royal flush. Royal flush. Royal flush. Royal flush. Royal flush. 50 hands of poker. Now, when his friends are getting up to like beat the tar out of him because he's cheating, he could say, wait. I know it looks suspicious, but what if there's an infinite succession of universes so that for any possible distribution of poker hands, there's one universe in which this possibility is realized. We just happen to find ourselves in the one where I always deal myself a royal flush without cheating. So technically, sure, that argument technically is possible and you couldn't prove it, but it's not rational. To say, we would all go, no, that guy's cheating. 50 straight royal flushes, there's no way you could do that. Imagine it this way. Suppose a man is lined up to be executed and a firing squad of 20 expert marksmen line up to shoot him from 6 feet away. And they line up and aim and shoot, dust settles, they all missed. Reload, shoot, they all missed. Reload, shoot, they all missed. Reload, shoot, they all missed. On and on and on. Given enough time, you would go, I think there's something happening here. Maybe there's a conspiracy. Maybe they're shooting blanks. That sure, you could reason and say, wow, these 20 expert markmen have shot 100 times from 6 feet away and they've all missed every time. But that wouldn't be reasonable. So in this series and as human beings, we want to use reason. And so I just find it fascinating that Dawkins gives completely unreasonable explanations for how fine-tuned the universe is. Here's the point. Every scientist agrees that the universe had a starting point and there was a tiny chance that our universe would ever come into existence, so tiny that it's classified as a miracle, and yet the atheist worldview, in order to keep a creator out of the picture uses illogical and irrational reasoning to explain how we got here. However, the Christian worldview does the exact opposite. In Psalm 19, David writes this, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge." What David is saying in Psalm 19 is when you look up at our universe, when you gaze through a telescope and you see the fine tuning of the universe that we live in, that's evidence for the handiwork of God. It's pointing to a creator. Something had to create this. Something outside of matter. Because remember, matter can't make itself happen. Which is why in John 4, it's amazing that Jesus says of God, God is spirit. Even in Genesis 1:1, God created the heavens and the earth, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. So God is actually outside of our material world, and so he can be the cause of all of our creation. Because he's not material. And so we go, logically, the Christian worldview of a creator makes the most sense. So when you gaze through a telescope, you see the bigness of our universe, it points to a creator. And the same is true when you go the opposite way. Our universe is immeasurably big, but it's also extremely small. And when you look through a microscope and you begin to see the building blocks of life, it again points to a creator. The nuts and bolts of life are what are called amino acids. And when amino acids are arranged perfectly, they form proteins, and when proteins are arranged perfectly, they form cells, and cells make up tissues, and tissues form organs, and organs work together to form an organism, so a human being. But here's the stunning thing. There are 20 amino acids that make up all of life, and in order for amino acids to form a protein, 150 to 3,000 of them have to be ordered in exactly the right sequence. Now, if you happen to get that right and you got a protein, in order for a protein to form one single cell, 250 to 3,000 proteins have to be arranged in the right sequence. Now, it hasn't been fully proven yet, but scientists have hypothesized that the human body is made up of 30 to 40 trillion cells. Now, an evolutionary atheistic worldview would look at that and say, well, lucky us, 3,000 amino acids just happen to arrange themselves in order and then form a protein, and then 3,000 proteins happen to arrange themselves in perfect order to form a cell, and that happened 30 trillion times in order to make a human being. And we're here, so it must have happened. Lucky us. Now think about it. DNA is your hereditary material. Nearly every cell in your body has the same DNA on it, and it's information stored that makes you, you. Now, one strand of DNA has 3 billion letters on it, and a DNA's diameter is 2 nanometers thick. And again, so small, we can't even really fathom that. So to give you some perspective, a strand of human hair is 100,000 nanometers, and your DNA is 2. And it holds 3 billion letters on it. And if your DNA were written down into a book, that book would be 1 million pages long, single-spaced, 12-point font. So when you actually begin to look at the complexity of human life at a molecular level, it's astounding. But then go a step further and dig into some deep metaphysical questions that come up. All the cells in your body are replaced approximately every 7 years, and yet you remain the same person. How is it that a collection of amino acids, because from an evolutionary, strictly atheistic worldview, you're just a bag of meat with bones in it. You're just amino acids that happen to come together. Now, how can just a collection of amino acids have thoughts about amino acids? How do we have consciousness? If we're just a collection of random cells, why can we use our brains and think? And like, you are self-aware right now. If you're just a collection of random cells, you would not be self-aware. And so you begin to ask these questions. Okay, if it's just random, then there's no answers to these questions. There's actually something more to humanity than just random cells. And yet, if you believe an atheistic evolutionary worldview, there is no meaning. And the illogical reasoning behind us being here is, well, we just kind of lucked out. So actually, it takes way more faith to be an atheist. I don't have that kind of faith. To believe in random chance and random luck for the universe to come into being, to have no explanation for why the universe began to exist, to have no reason for the small chance of our universe being here, rather than shrugging your shoulders and saying, well, lucky us. Like, I don't have that kind of faith to be an atheist. That's way harder. The universe is actually pointing to the existence of God. When you look through a telescope and when you look through a microscope, God's fingerprints are everywhere. It's all evidence pointing to Him. The last evidence or clue for the existence of God that we want to look at this morning is morality. Because here's the thing, everyone agrees that there is an unspoken yet agreed upon understanding of the universe. That there is an objective standard of fair and that we should follow the rules. If you have kids, think about it. Even your kids know this. You don't even necessarily have to teach them that. Kids just know it. I have two kids and I can't tell you how many times I've had to split up fights between my girls around these issues. Well, she has an apple. I want an apple. It's only fair. And I go, says who? I don't actually say that. I'm a good father, so I give them an apple. Or my youngest will say, Sissy, sister, took my toy. That's not fair. I want it back. And I say, why isn't that fair? And yet from a young age, like my youngest, she's 2 years old, and she wants instant justice. She'll come downstairs and she'll say, Sissy took it out of my hand. Like angry. I'm like, whoa, okay, we need some counseling. But I'm like, where does that come from? She's two, and yet she inherently knows you shouldn't take things from other people. Or if you get something, then I should get something because then that's fair. And I go, well, why? Why is that fair? So even our kids, like even adults, when someone cuts you off in traffic or cuts in front of you in line, that makes you mad, and we should all ask why. Why is that not right? Why shouldn't they cut in front of you? And we go, well, that's not fair. Well, why? Why do we have this understanding of right and wrong and fair? You see, there are moral standards and values in our culture that we hold to. Actually, regardless of culture, universally, we know that murder is wrong. We know that rape is wrong. We know that stealing is wrong. And we all live knowing that inherently we shouldn't do those things. But then you have to ask, well, where does that come from? Because a skeptic or an atheist, or someone with an evolutionary worldview would say, well, moral values are objective, are not objective, but they come from evolutionary development. They're socially constructed. So your morals are just a product of your society, your upbringing, your culture. So what that means is there's not a set standard of morality, but morality just kind of comes through the process of evolution, what helped us survive. And again, they stress, well, morality is a social construct. So societies and cultures form their own morality. Now, there's a massive problem with that. The next time someone tells you that morality is not objective, but societies and cultures create their own morality, punch them in the side of the head. Now, I'll tell you why. Because when they wake up or they get up and they go, why'd you do that? Just say, well, in my culture, that's how we say hello. That's how we show love in my culture, baby. I love you. Now, don't actually do that because then I'll get emails like, my pastor told me to punch people. Don't actually do that. But think about it. If morality is just culturally based, then you have no basis to say that that's right or wrong. You could say, I don't like being punched in the head. But if that's how they say hello in another part of the world, you can't say that it's wrong. So even, like, think about it this way. Seriously, if you follow that line of thinking, so it, logically, if I went to a remote village, if I have this worldview, and I go to the Amazon, deep in the jungle, meet some tribe, and I'm with my wife, and they take my wife, capture her, tie her up, torture her, and eat her, how would I feel about that? Now, if I have an evolutionary, culturally constructed view of morality, I cannot say that what they did was wrong. I could say I don't like it, but if that's right in their society, then I would just have to go, hey, I didn't like it, but it's not wrong. So you can see logically it actually doesn't make any sense because we know that eating people is wrong. And yet, if you follow that line of thinking, all you could simply say to that tribe is, I didn't like what you did, but you were morally okay doing it. So the position completely falls apart because inherently we do believe that there is a moral code, and we believe that there are things in the world that people shouldn't do no matter what, even if they think it's right or wrong. So here's an example of the hypocrisy that exists with people who claim morality is simply subjective. No one can tell us what is right or wrong. In the 60s and the 70s, there was this big movement, the sexual revolution took place. Now, I'm not old enough to remember that, born in 86, but some of you will remember that. Maybe you were a part of it, or you just remember that happening in the 60s and 70s. And the cry of that generation was, my body's my own, I can do what I want with it, I can be sexual and promiscuous, and you can't tell me it's wrong. Morality is relative. What's right for you is not right for me. So I can do whatever I want. All morality is subjective. Don't tell me that's wrong. And yet in the same breath, those people condemned and protested the Vietnam War as being morally unjust. And you go, you can't have it both ways. So how can you say my morals or my own when it comes to my sexuality can't be challenged by anyone, and yet I challenge the morality of going to war? You can't. If you really do believe that morality is subjective and you can be in charge, then who says that going to the Vietnam War was wrong? So you can see the hypocrisy. In one breath, they're saying morality is relative, I can do whatever I want, you guys shouldn't be doing that. And you go, you can't have it both ways. So it's actually impossible for anyone to be a consistent moral relativist in practice, even when you claim to be. Because lots of atheists claim that. Yes, I am completely a moral relativist. So ask them, if a tribe ate your wife, would you be mad at them? Well, yeah, because it's wrong. You can't say it's wrong. So actually, you can't. No one lives as if they're actually a moral relativist, because we all have this pervasive, powerful, unavoidable belief in moral values and moral obligation. People might laugh at the idea of a lawgiver or a transcendent morality, and yet no one thinks that racial genocide is just impractical. We know it's wrong. When one group of people slaughters an entire race, we don't go, that's not very practical. No, we go, that's evil, that's wrong. The Nazis, for instance, might have claimed that they didn't feel immoral for killing 6 million Jews, but none of us care about that because we go, that's wrong. But they could have said, hey, that was the culture we were raised in. Our culture decided that it was morally acceptable to do that, and you won't care about that. You would say, no, that's evil. And so I ask you, why is that evil? So the evolutionary response to this critique is really interesting. Skeptics have said, well, unselfish people survived in greater numbers than those who were selfish. And so those genes were passed on to us through evolution, and so now the majority of us feel that unselfish behavior is right. But again, that logically doesn't make sense. If morality and right and wrong are simply genes passed down to us from our ancestors, then the idea of showing hostility to a rival tribe would be considered just as moral and right, because it would have helped us survive, and yet no one lives like that. If you see someone drowning in a river, even a stranger, you will jump in to save them. But according to evolutionary processes, he's not in your tribe. He's a weaker species. Let him die. And yet none of us live like that. The problem is, if all morality is just culturally created, then I have no basis for judging one culture's morality to be better than another. And yet we all do that. We don't look at what ISIS is doing and saying, well, I don't like that, but it's morally acceptable to that culture. No, we say that's inherently evil and wrong. If morality is subjective and there's no God or moral lawgiver, then I have no right to say that one action is moral and another is immoral. I can only say my preference is that I don't like that. So who gets the right to define what is moral and what is immoral? And atheists often say, well, the majority decides. But I would push back and say, well, what if the majority decides to slaughter the minority? Then you're back at square one again. So if the evolutionary model for morality is true, then many of our modern social constructs don't make any sense at all. They're unexplainable. Saving someone's life in a strictly evolutionary worldview makes no sense. So for instance, a few years ago when the new Batman movie came out, some of you remember in Colorado, a man walked into a movie theater and started shooting people. And there was this news story where two young men who were on dates with their new girlfriends, threw them onto the ground, jumped on top of them. Both men were shot and killed, and their girlfriends survived. And on every news media outlet in the world, practically, it was, man, those men are heroes that they would do that. And actually, according to Darwinian evolution, those men are fools. Why would you give up your own life to save someone that you maybe were just starting to get to know? And also, if you believe in evolution, you have no right to point the finger and say the shooter was wrong. You may not like it, but you can't say that he was wrong. When you follow Darwin's theory of evolution to its natural conclusion, it's a bleak and cold and moralist world. Do you actually know Darwin's full title of his most popular book? This is his title, On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. That's his full title. Darwin, in his book, actually wrote that mentally challenged people shouldn't be allowed to marry or reproduce because that would hinder our progress as a species. If you're an evolutionary thinker, then naturally you look at races different than you and you think of them less based on the color of their skin. That is what evolution teaches. And yet no one lives like that. We condemn racism, and yet Darwin wrote about it that that's actually what we should be pursuing. Favored races. And yet globally, when we see racism, we all go, that's not right. And if you have an evolutionary worldview, I would push on that and say, well, why isn't that right? Isn't that the goal? An evolutionary worldview leaves no room for morality or right or wrong, and yet I find it fascinating that our entire world lives by those standards. And actually, the Christian worldview has an answer for why we do that. Paul, writing in Romans 2, says, "For when Gentiles who do not have the law by nature do what the law requires, they're a law to themselves, even though they don't have the law. They show the work of the law is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness, and their conflicting thoughts accuse or even excuse them." What Paul is saying is that God created everything, and God is the one who sets the moral standard for his creation. And even people who have never read the law, who don't know the law, even if you've never picked up a Bible in your life, you know that inherently it is wrong to kill someone, that it's wrong to steal, that it's wrong to rape. And what Paul is saying is it's because God has stitched that law on every human heart and given every human being a conscience to know right from wrong. And so there is objective moral standards for all of humanity, regardless of culture. So I find it fascinating because morality is actually a clue for the existence of God. Because if evolution and atheism were true, then humanity wouldn't have a moral compass. We may not like murder or rape, but we couldn't call it wrong. And yet everyone around the globe does. So the existence of the universe and morality both point to the existence of God. But here's the thing that I want to make sure is clear. You cannot prove 100% the existence of God. So we can't say, well, because morality exists, then 100% God exists. And yet God has given us clues and markers because I believe that God wants to be known. But we all come to the question of God's existence with a bias. So if you ask an atheist, hey, if God himself ripped the roof off your house and showed up in front of you, would you believe in him? And many times I've heard the answer, no. So actually, it's not a matter of evidence, but it's a matter of the heart. Some assume God doesn't exist because simply they don't want him to exist. Because listen, if God exists, then that drastically changes the way that you live your life. And so some just suppress that knowledge because they don't want God to exist. They don't want to see the evidence and they assume that he just can't exist. In an interview with Christopher Hitchens, a renowned atheist before he died of cancer, someone asked him, if you end up dying and God is real and you stand before him, what would you say to him? And Hitchens answered, I would tell God, why didn't you give me more evidence that you were real? So Andy Steiger in his book Thinking responds to that question like this. The truth is God has made himself known. Looking out for your interests, the King of Kings became a servant to woo the love of his beloved you. What more could God do than he's already done? Advertising his existence on a billboard wouldn't be loving. It would ruin us. Instead, he's left enough evidence behind to point us to him. So have you ever thought about that question in the opposite way? If God doesn't want to be known, why didn't he create the universe in such a way that we would neither look for him or find him? And yet here we live in a universe that is leading us straight to God. And God has given us enough evidence. He himself came in the person of Jesus, which we're going to talk about in the weeks to come. Because of his great love for us, God wants us to know him and to be known by him. God has given us clues and evidence for his existence, but the question is, are you actually willing to follow the evidence and trust not only that God is real, but that he actually loves you and that he's worth following? C.S. Lewis said this, and we'll end with this: I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. Would you pray with me? Heavenly Father, I just thank you that the universe really is screaming out the fact that you exist. God, I thank you from the fine-tuning of the universe to the smallest amino acid and an atom that is so intricately woven together. The fact that we have a moral code that inherently we know and we hold to. And on and on and on we could go, God. All of these things are pointing to the fact that you exist. I thank you that you don't leave us clawing around in the dark trying to guess if you exist, but you give us such solid evidence that you are real. And so, God, I pray for everyone in this room that, especially for those who maybe came and doubted God's existence or maybe were firm in their belief that there is no God. God, I pray that you would challenge their thinking, that they would actually use reason and logic and critical thinking to explore the evidence, and that, God, you would draw them to yourself. But I pray that we wouldn't just leave here with more head knowledge going, yeah, now I know that God exists, but that, God, we would want to know you intimately, that we would want to get to know this God of the universe, that you would draw us to yourself. And so, God, only you can do that work. We all have a bias, and only you are the one who can open up our eyes to see the truth of who you are. And so we ask that you would do that. Reveal yourself to us so that we can know and follow you. And so we pray all of this in your mighty name, God. Amen.